The incentive structure here for a select few to continue to do these is clear. The question is, who's actually paying for all of this down the road?
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic. Can't wait to talk about crypto treasury companies.
I know. It seems like it's in the news at least once a week, and maybe more than that nowadays. So we've definitely got a full show today. Well, with that, I'd just like to welcome everyone. Thank you for joining today's edition of the Crypto Brief. Today, I'm joined by Parth, Jack, and Max, and we're going to be covering crypto treasuries, one of the hottest topics in the industry right now. So I think we have an exciting show for everyone. But before that, we have a couple of news items that we want to cover. Max, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Matt. Just a few kind of really interesting stories that we won't spend too much time on here. But first is Circle announcing their new EVM layer one blockchain called Arc. They announced it on the 12th, so pretty recently. Just some brief highlights included that it'll feature a stablecoin FX engine. They have a focus on sub-second settlement and also really building out interoperability with other chains, which to me was kind of the most interesting point. And like naturally that opens the conversation to like how this impacts other L1s, including Ethereum, where a lot of their existing stablecoin lives.
Yeah, I think that this narrative of stablecoin infrastructure has continued to heat up this year. According to my count, that's six or so L1s or L2s that are like going to be infrastructure that's dedicated specifically to stablecoins. Codex is an L2 that got announced that they had raised around from some big VCs. One Money Network is an EVM L1 specifically for stablecoins, again, that announced a big fundraising round. Plasma and Stable.xyz both announced fundraising this year and have backing from Tether, Paolo, Bitfinex, some combination of various Tether entities. This Circle announcement for Arc is an EVM L1 that's going to be stablecoin specific. And then there's rumors around Stripe having a network called Tempo that's going to be an EVM L1. Again, another payments stablecoin focused network. So that's six of these. Also interesting that both Tether and Circle, the largest stablecoin issuers, are putting capital behind or creating themselves stablecoin specific infrastructure. So I think if any network is sort of most vulnerable to this, I would argue it might be Tron, because a lot of the volume of Tether stablecoin transactions actually happens on Tron, even though it does happen on Ethereum and Solana as well. But yeah, it's interesting.
Max, from my perspective, as we see this Cambrian explosion of stablecoin L1s, I think it also fragments the ecosystem. And there's also a really good opportunity for a platform which connects across these stablecoin L1s. So almost a network of networks, so to speak, which helps you move liquidity from these silos. And so it kind of goes back to interop, but I think just a network of networks is something, because at some point they all have to reconvene and these silos have to interact with each other.
Yeah, I was seeing a lot of tweets over the past week or so that like Chainlink and Layer Zero Wormhole, like these are the biggest winners of all of these announcements for everybody wanting to launch their own L1, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's just too many networks to connect at this point. A lot of value there. Makes sense.
Well, maybe speaking of proliferation and Cambrian explosion, that maybe that's a good segue to crypto treasury companies. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that we can kick it off there. I certainly think that there's a lot of background knowledge and history that we need to cover before we can get into this. So just as kind of a refresher, what are we talking about when we're talking about crypto treasury companies? Typically, we're talking about a mix of companies, whether that be blank check vehicles, small cap stocks, or just operating companies that have adopted a digital asset to hold in their crypto treasury. And so this all started in 2020 in August when MicroStrategy announced that as an inflation hedge, they were going to purchase Bitcoin for their balance sheet. And as we all know, they have continued to do so. They've actually done 74 different Bitcoin purchases to date, and they hold over 600,000 Bitcoin. But the trend certainly didn't stop there. Later in the year, or in 2021, Tesla announced that they were going to adopt Bitcoin as well. Now, they backed away from that strategy a little bit, but we then saw Block, formerly known as Square, also adopt Bitcoin for their balance sheet. And then really over the past 2 years, this trend has really exploded. Metaplanet announced in June 2024 that they were going to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And then we now have, I believe it's 74 different companies holding digital assets on their balance sheet. We've seen a huge trend in recent months into ETH treasury companies. So we're seeing really an explosion of this strategy. And there's a lot of different nuances that I think we need to cover and get into.
Well, I have a few suspicions on why these companies are taking off now. And it kind of leads back to this sudden big demand or stronger appetite for crypto-related equities. This year, 2025, has been kind of the coming out moment for crypto in terms of legitimacy, especially with regulatory clarity. So I'd imagine that a lot of traditional equity investors feel the desire to get access to crypto-related exposure. And you're seeing some of that show up in market activity with Coinbase, Robinhood, Galaxy, or even IPOs like Circle. So I think it's that inherent demand to get some kind of exposure related to crypto now that you see a lot of positive legislation.
Yeah, I've heard the ParaFi team, who a venture organization in the crypto space who's been doing a lot in the digital asset treasury space, calling it reverse tokenization, which is kind of funny because obviously we spend a lot of time on here talking about tokenizing like equities on chain and then being able to do things in DeFi with them. But right now we kind of have the reverse taking place where it's like these decentralized digital assets being put into centralized entities that trade on like NYSE and NASDAQ, which I think is funny, but there's something to it, which is like providing access to various forms of exposure to various investment pools that may not be able to access even via an ETF. So there are like some public fund managers that, you know, via their prospectus, they would, their organization would have to update their rules and mandates to allow them to be able to own like the Bitcoin spot ETPs. And so they can't. And so one way that they can get exposure to crypto or the volatility that underlies it is via these various offerings.
So maybe, Jack, if I take a step back, because I do feel like at some point it's all going to be one and we won't be talking about tokenization or reverse tokenization. It's going to be all the same rails. But how, for someone who's completely new to crypto treasury companies or DATs, digital asset treasuries, How does it work? What are different types of transaction structures?
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is you have investors that have capital that want to start these things because they've seen the historical track record of, you know, obviously MicroStrategy being sort of the first pioneer of this strategy, but also a handful of others globally that have seen success with this. And if they're able to issue equity at a premium to the net asset value of their balance sheet, that seems, you know, quite attractive. Whether or not that lasts in perpetuity, I think, is another question, which we'll probably touch on at some point in this conversation. But for the time being, you know, we're seeing pools of venture money effectively approach, whether it be SPACs, so special purpose acquisition vehicles, which are basically like publicly listed sort of companies or blank check vehicles, essentially, where money can then enter and a company can sort of be started or formed via this SPAC that there is no real underlying business, but there's a ticker that trades. So that's sort of one format where we have these SPACs taking place and they take a few months to actually close the transaction and sort of confirm it from a regulatory perspective. And then in other instances, we have just what's called PIPEs, private investment in public equity, into like pre-existing microcap businesses that are like $10 or $20 million market cap businesses that are largely, I would argue, are like irrelevant. And the business sort of has nothing to do with what the strategy is, because investors basically say, hey, you know, they approach management and they say, we have this idea. We want to put, you know, whether it be $100 or $200 million into this $10 million business. So they would issue you know, 20 times the amount of shares of common stock that exists currently. This is just like a broad example. And then the business would become mostly irrelevant, the little operating business that exists, and they would buy a bunch of Bitcoin or Ethereum or Solana with all of this newfound cash, and then run some sort of strategy to accumulate potentially more, whatever it is, Bitcoin per share out in the market via various accretive financing events that the public market might allow them.
Jack, do you think this strategy is more popular compared to going the SPAC route, especially as we see with crypto treasury companies? Because I would imagine if you are a small microcap company, the benefit you have is that you're already a public company. So these crypto treasury companies get access to US capital markets on day one. So it's much quicker to raise capital if you're already a seasoned issuer. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I don't know what the breakdown is between how many of these are actually being done via a SPAC or via like a pre-existing operating business. I've seen both. We've seen, you know, a number of examples of both happening. But you raise a good point, which is from the bankers who are running these acquisitions and financing events, it's very accretive for them, and they don't really ultimately care of the true outcome here for investors, right? If we're just like looking at the dollars and cents of it, they see, you know, the ability to make a good amount of money on a pretty large transaction in these small companies. And at the same time, the management teams of these companies, if you're management of some small business that in some cases, I mean, in order to be open to this idea, the business is probably not doing all that well, I would assume in most cases. And there's an incentive structure of like, hey, some new hot money is going to come in here and make this business relevant again. And you already own a bunch of these shares. Maybe we'll top you up and you'll own some more as a part of this. And those shares could be worth multiples more than they are today after we actually run this strategy. And so like the incentive structure here for a select few to continue to do these is clear. The question is like, who's actually paying for all of this down the road? Which we can certainly talk about. But there's new money coming in, and you know, the money's not just coming from nowhere here, right?
I guess before we move on, just to confirm, like the difference or the trade-off between those two routes is like timing. You're trading off timing for the SPAC route versus like now you have a little bit of a messier underlying business and capital structure for the pipe route. Is that correct? Potentially, depending on.
Yeah, that's sort of like the basic idea of how I've sort of understood it. And it, again, there's examples of both.
I would just say, like, I would also add in the SPAC route, a lot of what we've seen is like you issue a SPAC and then you approach a very large Bitcoin holder and you can just tell them, hey, look, you have 800 Bitcoin, which is worth, you know, market price today. Would you like it to be worth a multiple of that? Because these SPACs typically trade in a multiple to MNAV. And that's a pretty attractive, you know, offering and opportunity.
Yeah. So some of these SPACs now have sort of, I think, like caught on to the fact that like, hey, it takes a few months for these to close. And like, what if the price of the underlying rises and like, we're just sort of sitting in cash here. And so some of them have actually had like contributions in kind in the tokens ahead of time. And like, if the SPAC fails to close, they're like, we'll just give you back the tokens that you contribute, or you contribute in cash and they'll buy the tokens on your behalf. And then you're sort of agreeing if the SPAC doesn't go through that you'll just get back those tokens. So they're starting to like try to figure out how to account for that in that structure as well.
So just to kind of reel us back in. So as a digital asset treasury company, I have two routes. I can go the SPAC route or I can go be a small microcap company. Jack, what happens after? Can you raise debt? Can you raise equity, issue stocks? What's the next step here?
I mean, what they're tending to do is, okay, we make this announcement and now this company that has, you know, let's just use Bitcoin as the underlying asset, will announce that they took in this new money, that they bought Bitcoin, or that they're planning to buy Bitcoin with the proceeds. And then in the current market environment, a lot of these names end up popping and retail or whoever is bidding these stocks up tends to bid them to a premium to relative to the underlying assets. And so if a stock trades at 2x its underlying balance sheet, or 2x MNAV is what people are using as the terminology now. We're inventing all these new terms around digital asset companies, which maybe is a warning sign or maybe not. But multiple to NAV, MNAV. And management of these companies will then say, hey, if we're trading at 2x the value of our actual balance sheet, we can issue more common shares. And so do at-the-money offerings of new shares, and we get $2 for every dollar of asset that we're holding on our balance sheet. And so that's actually accretive financing for each existing shareholder, because they're getting $2 and they're giving out shares where the business really only holds a dollar. You could argue that, like, at some point, the supply of all of these new shares will probably meet demand, but we're not at that point today. And so on one end, it's just more common shares being issued when the stock trades at a premium to its net asset value. And the new marginal buyer is effectively the one paying that premium, and the existing shareholders benefit. And so if these stocks continue to trade at a meaningful premium to their underlying net asset value, then management will likely continue to issue shares and purchase more of the underlying. And you can see how this is sort of creates like a reflexive cycle, where if the underlying goes up in price, people get more bullish and euphoric, and there's more momentum behind these things, and they think that the strategy is working. And so therefore, the multiple to net asset value often expands in a bull market. Therefore, management will issue more shares, because if it's trading at 3x its underlying net asset value, then that's even more accretive to existing shareholders. And then they buy more of the underlying. And so you can see, like, you can run that cycle forward of it could lead to this like crack up boom. The question is, on the other side, how sustainable that is when those premium to NAVs compress, and what the response function will look like on that end. But equity issuance is one, and that's what a lot of these strategies are doing. And then several of them are also going out to convertible debt markets and offering, basically levering the balance sheet via convertible debt. And convertible debt is debt that comes with an equity option associated with it. And so the financing on that is low, because there's an equity option that adds value to the offering. And so companies like MicroStrategy, for instance, are offering convertible debt, and there's demand for it because investors will buy it and have the optionality or upside, and there are pools of capital that can only invest in convertibles. And now they're being offered, you know, this convertible that has high degrees of volatility and has an option associated with it that has a high implied volatility, that you could sell options against it, and convertible ARB funds like it. And so that's a form of leverage that's actually being added to some of these balance sheets, particularly one the larger Bitcoin and Ethereum-based treasury companies. So we're seeing both equity issuance when these companies are trading at a premium to NAV, also debt issuance, and then we can talk about preferreds as well, which are a smaller part to the story. But basically taking advantage of the capital structure that these public businesses have and the various levers that they can pull on to raise capital and purchase more of the underlying asset, and in hopes that each existing shareholder will own more and more of the underlying asset over time.
Jack, as part of learning more about crypto treasury companies, I mentioned this before, but I spoke to one of my high school mates who works in this team called BTC, which is Bitcoin Treasury Core, and I'm not going to name the name of the company. And he was talking about how a lot of investors who want to participate in this like the idea of convertible debt, purely because you get the equity-like upside when you have convertible debt, as opposed to just regular debt. But you also get some kind of downside protection if you participate in this. So the equity-like upside is that if, you know, if the company stock price exceeds the conversion price, you can capture gains. But on the other side, if the stock underperforms or if there's a Bitcoin crash, then the investors don't convert and they hold on to the debt. And so I think, like you said, there's some really clever financial engineering involved. I kind of want to go back to a few points that you made earlier. And there was this article which was kind of doing a lot of rounds, which said US public equity markets will pay $2 for $1 worth of Bitcoin. And it kind of makes you think, well, you know, why would they do that? It's just, it's irrational. right? Because if you're buying something like MicroStrategy at 2x NAV, you're effectively buying half a Bitcoin as opposed to buying one Bitcoin. I'd imagine that there's also, you know, part of the strategy for something like this also requires a lot of retail attention and really strong marketing awareness, which means it has to start with an asset that's widely recognized, that a lot of people want or desire, and it's also kind of hard to get, right? So it's kind of how MicroStrategy did really well in that space, that it was really hard for people to get Bitcoin or to get access to Bitcoin, but at the same time, there was a strong appetite to have exposure to Bitcoin.
I completely agree. And I think there's an argument to be made. Maybe I could give the positive and negative, or the bull and bear case on these, which is, I guess the bull case is there are pools of capital that can't otherwise get access to the underlying. I think that's less and less the case as time goes on when you have publicly traded ETPs, etc. But for some, that is true. And then the other piece would be for some of these companies that are able to then layer on various forms of leverage on the balance sheet, that is actually leverage that like the average retail investor can't get access to. Like you and I, if we wanted to and we owned Bitcoin, we could get access to a margin loan, but that margin loan could get liquidated or called in if the price of Bitcoin goes under, you know, whatever our sort of maintenance margin requirements are. Whereas the convertible debt offerings in most of these cases, from my understanding, is, you know, they're termed out, you know, 4 or 5 years, and it has nothing to do with the underlying Bitcoin price. It has to do with the fact that the equity conversion can take place if the share price rises, or in 4 or 5 years, the debt will be paid back at that maturity, or it'll be rolled via a new offering of convertibles if they're able to access financing. And so that is a different type of leverage that's able to be put on these balance sheets. And therefore, like the argument would be that this is like a leveraged vehicle with a unique type of leverage that you couldn't otherwise access. And therefore, it justifies some premium to net asset value. I do think by and large, the bearish argument here, which to me, I think at some point makes sense, is like, there's clearly incentives for more and more of these vehicles to exist if the market allows it. And eventually demand will be met with supply of new vehicles and new offerings, and that will cause more competition and likely compress the multiple to net asset value more and more towards a rational level, which would arguably be 1x or nearly 1x. And then some of these vehicles maybe could trade below 1x. And then what does that mean for the broader spot market for Bitcoin, Ethereum, and these other crypto assets?
Yeah. I think that is a great point, and maybe is a good jumping off point to start talking about some of the risks with these vehicles, right? Like, as you mentioned, Jack, they're reflexive to the upside. But if something's reflexive to the upside, that also means it can be reflexive to the downside. And what that might look like if these vehicles start trading at NAV or even below NAV.
Yeah, totally. So then like on the downside, the question is, how do these management teams respond? Let's just walk through a hypothetical. If when these things trade at a premium to NAV, the accretive thing, if your goal is more Bitcoin per existing shareholder, per share, when it trades at a premium to NAV, the rational or smart thing to do, financial theory would say, is issue more shares and buy more of the underlying. It's basically like functioning like an ETF, like an authorized participant of an ETF, where when it trades at a premium, you create more shares. And when it trades at a discount, you actually redeem shares or get rid of them. And the way that you do that is you sell the underlying basket of assets and buy back the shares. And so it's the reverse function of what you're doing on the upside. So the question is, will these management teams, if some of these stocks trade at a discount to their net asset value, because maybe the demand for these vehicles goes away, but now you have all this new supply, so some of them could trade at a discount, will they sell the underlying and buy back their own shares, again, to increase the assets per share, the Bitcoin per share, whatever the asset is? I don't know. I think some might. I think some that are more like, I don't know, philosophically view like Bitcoin as the new asset that's going to take over the world or something of that ill would like maybe be against it. And then I don't know what that means for the market, but you would just have a bunch of supply that is available? And then could we see like consolidation of these companies or one of these larger treasury companies, instead of buying spot, if they were trading still at NAV or above NAV, they could actually acquire these smaller businesses and take in their digital assets?
Jack, that'll be the true testament of holding or just having diamond hands or kind of walking the talk. Because if that happens, I do feel like there's also broader systemic risk. I kind of go back to the role GBTC played in 2022, which during the series of crypto collapses. If you do have, we all understand Bitcoin and crypto assets can experience extreme price swings. If you remember 2021, at the peak and when it went down, it was 70% less than its original value in May 2022. And so a lot of this would also depend on investor confidence too. Now these treasury companies, if they have unrealized losses, they do have to report those in their earnings, which can obviously lead to investor confidence going down. And the broader impact is that institutional investors like hedge funds could potentially get margin called, which lead to fire sales, and that's never good for the equity market. Like if you remember 2022, firms like Voyager, Celsius, they did use leverage indirectly by lending user funds to leveraged borrowers like Triado Capital, some of the other hedge funds. And then these hedge funds also held their fiat at banks like Signature. So that was some systemic risk, and that led to a bank run. So I think there are true risks even before the scenario that you laid out, when they don't trade at the NAV anymore or at a multiple of a NAV anymore.
I mean, another thing I would add to that part is I think that we do actually have a case study for what can happen when you have essentially a digital asset treasury company underlying declines precipitously and they have to force sell. And that is in the form of Bitcoin miners in 2022. They were all heavily leveraged with these ASIC-backed financing loans, and they were holding all their Bitcoin on their balance sheet. But when Bitcoin went down and they still had to cover their operating costs and cover their debt service costs, they were forced to fire sale this Bitcoin into the market all at the same time, driving the price down precipitously. And then also on the back end, like, they had marked this Bitcoin at a much higher value on their balance sheet. And actually, the day they mined it, it was worth a lot more than when they were eventually forced to sell it. So there is reflexive downside risk here as well. And we've seen it previously, just in a different form.
There's another kind of risk, which is these treasury holdings require secure custody and need really good OPSEC from those custodians. So just a bad hack can potentially lead to wiping of those assets. And these crypto treasury companies more often than not use a custodian. So there's counterparty risk there. And as we see new kinds of companies which are holding Ethereum or Solana, so Ethereum or Solana treasury companies, now I understand a lot of these companies are still in the accumulation phase, but a portion of their capital will find its way on chain. And so what these firms do is to enhance risk-adjusted returns or put their assets to use, they tap into Ethereum staking or just the DeFi infrastructure, which obviously you don't see in Bitcoin treasuries. So we were talking about this before, but SharpLink Gaming stakes the majority of its holdings on Rocket Pool to drive revenue. And so on one hand, it does provide a stream and also some price appreciation, but there's a new counterparty risk involved, which is through DeFi smart contracts. So if you kind of peel the onion, you have the debt or stock created by a treasury company. That debt is used to buy crypto. That crypto is being held by a custodian. Those custodied assets could be potentially be in a staking pool. And those staked assets could be making yield on a DeFi lending protocol like Aave. So I'd say there's risk.
If I'm going to end this conversation from any perspective on my end, it's risk management is key right now. Make sure you understand what treasury companies you hold if you decide to invest, what they're doing with the underlying, what their ability to service debt in a downside scenario might look like. And then also always be aware of, you know, what will most likely happen, which is these MNAV compressions and how that could affect the market. I don't know if you guys have anything to add to kind of take away from this conversation.
No, I think you kind of covered it.
Awesome. Well, everyone, be careful out there. And I hope that this was a helpful conversation to kind of get into a broad and complicated topic. And we'll continue to keep everyone informed. But thank you, Parth, Max, and Jack, for a great conversation. And thank you, everyone, for joining.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.